sitting in the rain, waiting on the sun to shine.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are on remote. Cornelius Eady is here with us, poet, playwright, librettist, professor, musician. How do you like listening to your own music, Cornelius?
Well, Grace, I don't like listening to the sound of my own voice. It could be bad, the impression, but I do enjoy listening to my band, Charlie Rao and Lisa Liu. They're fantastic musicians, and it always brings me joy to hear them interact with one another.
So tell us something about making that music, the songs and the lyrics. Tell us how you did that.
Well, that song is the end of a long year, last year, when everyone was in lockdown. And what I did in lockdown was to simply start writing songs. Because partly to keep the trio together, right? We didn't know what we were going to do because gigs just disappeared, right? They just went, in a 72-hour period. And so we didn't know where we were going to play again, where we were going to perform again. So we just to keep our spirits up more than anything else. It wasn't like I'm going to now do this project, but it was sort of like song by song. And at the end of that process, a producer from the BBC, BBC Radio 4. Learned about the project and wanted to do a 30-minute show about my pandemic folk song project, which we now was calling Don't Get Dead. And he wanted an upbeat song to end the radio show. And I was kind of, we're all kind of like, I'm upbeat show. I don't want to do it. Oh, this is a pandemic. But I pushed myself to write an upbeat song and turn it into Sunshine, which turned out to be a really wonderful song. But which we love.
Very beautiful. We will be talking more about your music later on in the program. But because you are first and foremost one of America's greatest poets, let us hear a poem.
Okay. I'll do a newer one, a music one, music-based one. This is actually based on a conversation I had with the poet Afaw Weaver. And Afaw was working on a memoir, and he was on the chapter where he was talking about the first time he heard Miles Davis' famous album, Kind of Blue. And I was thinking, oh my God, that's right. We all have that, most of us have that experience of the first time we heard Kind of Blue. So it kicked off the poem, this poem called Kind of. My friend is writing about the first time he listened to Kind of Blue by Miles Davis. And I tell him, yes, I bet everyone has a story, kind of like their first kiss. How did it happen? Where were you? On which of your younger days did Paul Chambers' bass first lick your ear? Did you first think you didn't want anything to do with that crazy stuff? No words, no verse, chorus, music for sunglasses and cigarette holders? Did one of your friends, a convert, drag you to the stereo, fired up by the sight of a world wider than the narrow, invisible rails you were running on? The record is famous for this. The record that readjusts your opinion and you pause. The needle has hit a new groove. On which of your younger days did the afternoon simmer down and that smoothness called out to you and then everything else?
Simmer down, simmer down. Your word choices are music in themselves. Michael Afaw Weaver, had on the show in 1977, or so I need to get him back.
Yes, you do.
I think every 45 years.
He's written a lot since then.
He was brilliant then.
Yes.
I think he had Seven Sons Press. He was brilliant then. He is brilliant now. Yes. And so are you, Cornelius Eady. He is the author of many books, two prize-winning ones that I can think of. Victims of the Latest Dance Craze won the Lamont.
Right.
A Gathering of My Voice.
My Name was nominated for a Pulitzer.
Yes, it was a Pulitzer nominee.
Right.
And you have done many, many things. But let us hear one more poem before we go into your psyche.
Okay.
Which must be quite a journey.
Do you want to go into your psyche? Okay, here's a Billie Holiday poem. this is a newer one. I tend to go back to writing about Billy periodically. You know, just get drawn back to her. And this one's called Trees. Trees. There is a song that Billie Holiday sang concerning trees. She didn't write it, but when she sang, when she opened her mouth, she blew a sickening wind. Ash, rope, the lowering branch, blackened fruit. It was a southern pitch, particular to that soil. When she sang, you'd feel her fabric bleed. Unjust notes turning flesh to butter, unscrewing the cap between here and void, all sparrow and magpie calls polluted. She'd sing this night after night, the last thing you'd hear before you drain your glass and walk back into the world, your city, your block, trees thrumming rough bark in an evening gown. Here you go, the bad gardenia sang. Here's how we rise through strangulation.
Cornelius Eady, pitch particular to that soil. You know, jazz will never die.
No.
Not only because of its sound, but because of cultural historians like you who keep it alive with language. But how did a poet, everyone wants to know how a poet becomes a musician. How do you parlay that great energy that you had for language into sound? How did you become a songwriter from poet?
Well, there's no transition there. I always was writing songs. You know, it's neck and neck, right? Right. When I was younger, I was writing songs. I was in bands. My wife and I.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know.
My wife and I were in a rock band. I've been doing it on a parallel course throughout my writing career. It's just that I didn't put more emphasis on the songwriting. At a certain point, as I said to friends many times, you know, and also in interviews, there came a point where poetry got the upper hand, right? It just seemed like that was the path I was really supposed to be on, and I stopped writing songs less and less and less. But at a certain point, like around 2012 or 13, the pendulum started to swing back. And it was partly because I was going through my old files, my old records, my old papers, because I was about to sell them to a library. And I suddenly realized that a lot of those old tapes that I abandoned, that I left behind, was actually not that bad. you know. And the question I had to ask myself was, why did I drop that? I didn't have to. It really wasn't an either or. You know, in my mind at that time, it wasn't either or. You either have to be a poet, or you're going to have to be a songwriter, and you're going to have to choose, right? And I chose being a poet. But now looking back, I realized that was kind of a, you know, false dichotomy, as they say, right? You don't have to choose between the two, right? And at least for me, it did feel like I had to choose between the two. And I started to pay a little bit more attention to the songwriting, right? Also helped by the fact that I started to run into some really great musicians, beginning with my friend Robin Messing, who was a poet and a novelist.
Oh, yes.
Yes, right. She and I started singing together. On these tracks, I started to finish up those old tracks, and I brought Robin in to do some background vocals. That connected me to her daughter, Emma Alabaster, who was a bass player. Her partner at the time, Leo Ferguson, is a drummer, and also connected me to two other musicians, Charlie Rao on guitar and Concetta Abate on violin. At that time, they were both a duo by themselves, but they also knew Emma. So it was like this little telephone line kind of thing. Everyone knew everybody. And then I got a gig, and the gig was to open to read for Oliver Lake. And I turned it down because I, well, for whatever reasons, I turned it down. I didn't feel like what I was. And then I thought about it. I'd already started recording with them. We weren't a group yet, but I already started recording. And then a thought occurred to me and I called back the organizer. I said, well, you know, I might want to do this. If you let me play a set with my band, which didn't exist at that moment. The organizer said, fine, you know, and I called everyone up and said, I hope you guys, your schedule is open because I have this gig, but we're opening for Oliver Lake. They said, Oliver Lake, sure, you bet, right? Right. So that started the ball rolling. Running into these great musicians started to revitalize that part of my psyche, right? and then we're off to the races from that
point. So that is a wonderful story. If you call them, they will come.
Right.
If you get a book contract, you will write that book.
Well,
you got a gig and you got to get your band.
Well, you know the joke I often tell about this. I had to wait for my band to grow up to play with them. You know, why was I playing all those years? I was waiting for my band to grow up.
Isn't that you know? I never knew that you had a parallel life. I knew you wrote about music. I knew you were a scholar of music, but I never knew. Well, how did you learn to play the instruments?
I wouldn't call myself. I'm a singer. I'm a songwriter. I use the guitar as a tool. But I don't consider myself a guitarist in the sense that I can set Charlie and Lisa on guitarists, right? Lisa Liu, the other guitarist on my trio. They are disciples of the guitar, right? Like I am a disciple of poetry. Right, like you are a disciple of poetry, in our own way, right? You know, the idea of the craft of it, the way we inhabit it, right, is or the way we attune ourselves to the world through language, right?
That's right.
It's how we operate, and Charlie and Lisa operate that same way with music, right?
Oh yes, that's so interesting. We do understand the language, the world, through that paradigm of language. But you have so many gifts, it's almost not fair. You should share a little. And so now another poem. Cornelius Eady.
Okay, I'll do a jazz poem. This is about Thelonious Monk. And this is about a famous scuffle they had that was done on tape between Miles and Thelonious and, Milt Jackson. They were recording a tune, The Man I Love, on Christmas Eve, 1954. And if you listen to it, there's two takes of the opening. First take is basically, they're starting it, and then Miles has second thoughts about Monk playing it, because you know how it is with jazz musicians, it isn't how fast you can play, it's the ballad that tells you that proves if you got chops, right, or not. And Miles started to think that, Monk being Thelonious, he's gonna just do what he does. And it needs to be pretty and soulful. He's gonna do his fractured stuff. I don't want that. So you hear them starting, and then you hear Milt Jackson starting the head of the song, and then there's a commotion. And then you hear, Miles' voice going around, lay out, right? He's telling Monk to lay out. I don't want you to play on this, right? And then he goes over to the engineer, it was Rudy, right? The great engineer, and said, get this down, Rudy, all of it.
Oh, this is wonderful.
That stops, and it starts up again, right? It starts with take two, right? And then there's this beautiful opening. With Milt Jackson, right? It's better than the first one, right? And then they play the song. And of course, he's right. When Monk does his solo, he does ba 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 ba.
We have never had such a setup for a poem ever.
I know.
Our engineer is in heaven. Listening to you. Telling you.
But I've always loved that moment because. Not only because of the conflict, but also because Miles decided for some reason that it needed to be prime time. That he needed to keep that on the record, right? Right? That's the only reason we know about it, right? So anyway, piano solo, Thelonious Monk on The Man I Love. On the first take, Miles Davis tells Monk, strained, fingered Thelonious, to shut up, to lay out. It's a ballad. No tinkling brown pixie dust against the groove, no waddling through the measures like an albatross stalks up to the skies. Miles is a man who is used to having his own way. And if Monk were a woman, who knows where this might end? But then Milt Jackson rethinks the intro, the hushed tones of a man clearing his throat before his chords vibrate in prayer. And these five men, who seemed to have nothing better to do, Christmas Eve, 1954, get back to the lyric. Love is food, water, air. Lonely sucks. Then, from out of the negotiation, clinks Monk. Toy, piano, Monk. That stumble bum bird. The boy who will always grab the wrong crayon.
You know what? You make me cry. I'm not kidding. You just make me cry. Oh. It's just your heart, Cornelius. It is just your heart that just is in your words. I swear, I needed you today so much. I mean it. I saw Miles the last time he was in Washington, and all he did was one note. He got out on stage, and he played. We waited a long time, and he just played one note with his back to the audience.
With back to the audience.
That was, I'll never forget that note.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that note.
Yeah.
And you are memorializing these in such a way that it makes me cry. That's all I can say, that my body does not lie. But we have to go into all of your lives. And one of them is that you are professor of English after a stellar career in colleges, professor of English at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and chair of excellence.
Right.
Tell me this. Through your long career, when you encounter people who want to be poets, how do you begin? How do you start? What is the first thing you say?
Oh, well, the first thing they ask me, they usually don't ask you how to be a poet. They're already there by the time they arrive at a program. They've already made some choices and some considerations and changed the direction of their lives, you know, in a certain way towards that, right? And I always see that is like you. It's the first step towards the invention of your future self, the writer that you're going to, that's the public poet that's going to emerge 5, 6 years from now, right? Right. Those are the baby steps. But that's the desire that's going towards you. And what I do, hopefully, is try to make them aware of what the tools are, what the tools they have, and how best to hone those tools to discover how they want to say what they want to say as they move through experience, because that's what we do. And again, I go back to saying earlier, you know, but the thing, this is that poets have to learn to be attuned to the world, to language. That's how we do it, right? We're getting to that point where we develop to that point where basically that's the way our bodies become attuned to the world. Right? How we process it, right? And I'm one step on a longer journey that they're going to be going through. I'm not going to be the only person they're going to encounter, not the only books they're going to read, right? You know, but I'm part of that mix now, and my job at that point is not to get in their way, right? It's simply to show them what is possible and what they can do, you know, and also sort of to push them towards doing that, because sometimes writing is about just taking a chance, taking a leap, right? Or being able to give themselves permission to say stuff they don't think they can say, mm-hmm. right? And that happens a lot. You know, we see that a lot in Carvey Con, to bring that up.
Yes.
A lot of times I've noticed over the 25 years we've done Carvey Con that there's some poets, even poets that are in MFA or PhD programs, sometimes reserve the time at Carvey Con to say the poem they couldn't say anyplace else, to write the poem, to touch the story they couldn't touch anyplace else, because they feel that that's the only way they can do that. They can't do it in their MFA program. They can't do it, in the academy, but they feel safe enough to be able to say that.
We will want to talk more about Carvey Con, because that is one of America's greatest cultural institutions. But while we have you, one more poem. Make me cry.
Well, okay, I'm not going to make you cry. I mean, I feel really bad now.
No, I'm not kidding. I needed your spirit. You know, when you encounter a great spirit, I just want to get on my knees and say thank you. And that's what I'm feeling. Your spirit is just incredibly divine. It's just connected to the divine. And that's what these tears are saying.
You are so sweet, Grace.
No,
Grace,
go ahead. Really. Do it to me.
Let me do something that's not beat. Like, that's going to move you to tears or something. This is a poem about Aretha Franklin at Obama's inauguration. That one thing about that wonderful hat she wore, right? right. And connection to my sister. So Aretha Franklin's inaugural hat. Look at that hat. My mother might have said, sitting in that bunker the living room had become, her favorite shows interrupted by the sight of this woman, who once sang my sister through one of her major heartbreaks, and I give then take away man, with a truth which rose through the house. I was too young to know which kind of truth, really, and my sister was now learning the words. Her belly would swell from it. Ain't no way, ain't no way, sang the girl who was slightly older than my sister, old enough to teach it. Ain't no way, ain't no way. The needle scratched and scratched again. It's not too far-fetched to think of it breaking skin, a rush of something toxic, tear-raising. Remember when she didn't want to tell us, but told us, by playing that damn record all day, over and over in her bedroom. That's the woman, that's the woman under that hat, I'd tell my mother. If she'd ask, that church hat, that black woman's hat, that testimony hat.
That's the woman under the hat, all right. That's the woman under the hat, for sure. Are you on any more of these new poems? Are you on further and farther with more of these cultural icons?
Well, those are kind of older poems. I read the first two poems, which were kind of new. I'm kind of gathering up the next book.
What is it about? What's it going to be about?
There's a lot of things that there's a lot of threads going on right now. One thread is a series of poems I'm writing about Phyllis Wheatley. And you know, the emphasis on this cycle is her, you know, the transition from her own native tongue to English. What it might have felt like to lose her tongue, and then learn how to do English, how to speak.
How much have you accomplished?
I've got about I'd say about 12 or so poems done by now.
Just beginning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's an ongoing thing. It started from a conversation I had years ago in Washington State, I believe, and with an African American scholar who we were talking about Phyllis Wheatley, and she, you know, piqued my interest, my curiosity by saying one thing, saying something. It's like basically reminding me, number one, that Phyllis Wheatley was not. She was a baby when she came over, when she was captured, but she is like 6 or 7 years old when she was captured and then brought over. And that means that she was old enough to know her parents' name, to know her name, to know lots of people, the village she came from, the people who lived in the village. You're 7 or 8 years old, you know enough about life by then. And what was it like? Because, and if you read her book, her one book, that was published in England, and then, you know,
Her poems.
Right. You will notice every so often, threaded through the book, she will give reference to the memory of being in Africa, right? And there was one poem in particular I start the cycle with, where I quote from one of her poems that actually talks about wondering about her mother and dad, wonder how they must feel, right? The second thing was another thing that, as you know, the book was published in England. You know, and to publish the book, Phyllis and a Wheatley representative, I forget which family member, they went over to England. Now, the moment she stepped foot on English soil, she was a free woman, right? But she went back, right? The book was published. The book was a sensation in England. You know, and you know, she was whined and dined. She was a little bit of Oprah at that moment, right? And you know, and then. Came word that one of the Wheatley's family, that one of the daughters of Mrs. Wheatley herself was ill, and so she just got back on the boat and went back to slavery and went back to Boston. And the scholar asked me, well, why would she do that? Right. So that's the engine.
Why would he do that? So that was the trigger.
Yeah.
That was the trigger. Oh, are these going to be in her voice?
No. They're actually
in the narrator's voice.
They're in the writer's voice. Okay. They're in the writer's voice. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to hear another song of yours right now. And which one would you like us to play? The Titanic or the love song?
Which love song are we talking about?
It's the one you didn't write yet. Okay, so now we're going to hear a song by Cornelius Eady, who did the music and the lyrics.
The wolf is hungry at my door, but Lord, I'm hungry too. All I ask is a little boat. What else can a poor boy do? Lord, lend me a little boat for me and my friends to float. Lord, lend me a little boat for me and my friends to float. Oh, the time is out of joint, the tide is rising high. All I want is a little boat for me and my friends to fly. Lord, lend me a little boat for me and my friends to float. Lord, lend me a little boat for me and my friends to float. Someday, all I need is a little boat. What else can a poor boy say? Lord, lend me a little boat for me and my friends to float. Lord, lend me a little boat for me and my friends to float.
And so, once again, does it sound good to you?
Yes, it does. It does. It's like I said, the pleasure is also, it's always listening to Charlie and Lisa. Go at it.
You know? And you know, it doesn't, sometimes probably the creator doesn't have time to sit down and listen to the creation. I bet you don't listen to your own music enough.
Well, no, that's not true. That's not true, because especially this year, because the way we started working, you know, we really just had no alternative but to do it remotely. So what happens, you know, when we usually work, what happens is that up until last year, what I would do is that I would, you know, do a rough demo for them and send it to them, and then we'd all meet at my apartment, our apartment in the West Village, and when we work it out there, right?
You know, I would love to have seen that.
It's fun. Well, we just finally got back doing that a couple weeks ago. That was a thrilling, you know, go back. But for this, it's like we can no longer be in the same room at the same time, right? So how do you work it? So instead of just doing the demo, I'd send them the demo, and then I'd send it over to them. Then Charlie would add a part and send it over to Lisa, and Lisa would add a part. And then we'd all mix it. Then they'd mix it together, and we had to figure out, you know, how that was working. So it's a slightly longer process, and you really have to listen to the different parts in order to make it work, right? Sometimes we do like something that would have taken minutes for us to do. Sometimes takes hours, or sometimes days to do.
Depending on what it is.
Because, you know, sometimes it's like you get the part, and then somehow the guitar is a little higher than it needs to be, and so you have to go back, and Charlie has to readjust it, and that kind of thing. And we did that for a year, you know, but it was a good process. We got a lot of work out of it. I mean, I think we did about between 50 or 60 songs over that
year. So fascinating. That I'm so glad you described that process, because people just didn't know how you were doing this. Well, when you did live performances, where were you performing?
Well, we weren't doing live performances until last Sunday. For the first time in over a year, we played live at Guildhall in East Hampton. And, you know, we did an hour set, you know, and it was great to be on stage again.
You did perform before COVID.
Yes. The way we performed for COVID was that we did the same process to make a video, make videos together, right?
Oh.
And then we edited the videos together. So all the videos that came out of last year, it's not us playing in real time. We do the song, Charlie or Lisa will set the music bed, send it back to me. I will record myself singing the lead, sending it over to Charlie or Lisa. They add their part, and then they decide who's going to.
Who did the technical together. Though? Was there
both of them? And that was something that came out of COVID too. They learned how to do it over the year, right? Over last year.
So COVID did create something that we can be proud of, really. You have overcome a wall that was an impossible thing, and you did it. That is very interesting to me. Very. Well, before we hear a final poem, we have to talk about the creation of Cave Canem with the divine Toy Derricotte. Yes. And it had to be in the 80s, if I remember.
It was 90-something. 96.
Oh, was it 90?
96, 90-something, right?
It feels 20 years ago.
It's 25 years. We're going to do our 25th anniversary starting next week.
What are you doing?
Well, we're doing a number of events. We're starting with a celebratory dinner online, of course, and then we're going to be doing workshops again online. You know, it's going to be like, you know.
Just tell people what it is how many people have gone through that magic door.
Oh yes, Cave Canem is an African American poetry workshop, extensively, that Toy and I began, 25 years ago. It was to give a safe space for African American poets to hang and write and create and just to be. And a lot of people have gone through it.
See these prize winning poets, and in their resumes are Cave Canem.
Yes, you know.
Aren't you proud?
Yeah, it's also surprising why I haven't done this interview with you for almost 20 years, right? 20 years ago, it was a totally different landscape, right? And you know, a totally different landscape. And you know, you'd be lucky, the conventional wisdom then was sort of like you get Gwendolyn Brooks, and then 30 years later you get Rita Dove, right, with the Pulitzer, and then maybe a couple years later, you know, it wasn't a faucet. The faucet was a little trickle, right? And you know, over the last few years, over the last 25 years, you know, every poet since Rita Dove, who's won the Pulitzer, has either been a Cave Canem fellow or had a connection to Cave Canem.
Or taught.
So it's one of those things where you
Whoa.
Know.
Whoa, we need a book. We need a memoir.
Yeah. We're thinking about that. We're trying to figure out how to.
With the poems that came out. Yeah. Oh, an anthology. Got to have it.
Grace, we're definitely thinking about that, but trying to figure out how to make that work is going to
be hundreds of pages.
Right, because there's over 400 people have gone through Cave Canem over the 25 years we've been in existence. And yes, you know, prizes isn't the only way you measure, you know, the worth of a poet, you know, but it is really astonishing to see how Cave Canem has had this influence on American poetry. It's also, you know, made people reconsider what African American poetry is and what it contains.
It always takes one or two people to do something. It took you and Toy to create that. You can't wait for the other person to do it. They will not. You have to do it. You did it. You did it.
Yeah,
and now we have to have a final poem.
Oh, okay. Yes. Let me see. I'm having so much fun talking, Grace. I forgot what I was thinking about.
You like to make people cry.
So let me see if I can find something.
You don't happen to have the couch on hand, do you?
No, I do happen to have that on hand.
The white couch? That's an awesome poem.
Oh, that's a great poem to close with. I will do this, okay?
It's so you.
Okay. All right. So this is a about the my wife and I, we're renters. We've owned houses since then, but it's one of those things where basically we've been renters for a long time, and then we bought a house in upstate New York in Greene County. Mm. I say house is more like, you know, there's two cottages, you know, kind of broken down cottages side by side, you know, and the driveway between them. But we never had ownership before. The white couch that I found on the curb, a door or two down from the new school in New York, just at the moment my wife and I were looking for furniture for our new house. This is how marriage works. Guy and gal fall in love. Gal moves in. The bachelor pad with the clean, white IKEA sofa is out. This is the way marriage works. Guy and gal buy house. Guy and gal fight over what should go in it. Both problems get settled in the street. I sit on the couch. The couch is mine. I grab my cell phone. I call my wife at work. I found a couch. I cannot move or we lose the couch. The couch is perfect. The couch is free. I wait for Sarah. I guard the couch. Don't touch the couch. Don't consider the couch. And now it starts to rain. I will not move from the couch. And now the sun goes down. I will not budge off the couch. Sarah arrives. The couch is perfect. The couch is free. We guard the couch. We are too weak to lift the couch. We are too few to carry the couch. We fear the rain will soak the couch. We are on the couch, but let's be real. It's New York City. We're easy pickings on the couch. A truck might roll by and take the couch. Maybe we're not meant to have this couch. Maybe we're not worthy. Maybe the Greek gods are having fun with us. Look at them, fools! They will not budge off the couch! Then the torrent, the East Village skinhead, the cops. We need a car to carry the couch. We need some ropes to tie down the couch. One of us must leave the couch. One of us must guard the couch. I am the one who leaves the couch. I am the one who looks for Sarah's mom, who gives me her key, who lends us her car. I am the one who walks the streets searching for hope. Anyone who thinks New York never sleeps, so search for a rope after 9 p.m. I drift from grocery to magazine shop. What do they think I'm after? My friend, I need something heavier than twine. I examine package after package like a wine snob. Too thin. Too short. Not enough F. Maybe they grunt at what I choose and wait for the headline tomorrow. Oh, yeah, that guy. Night has fallen on the couch. Rain is falling on the couch. My wife is sitting on the couch. What will happen next? How shall we lift the couch? How will we tie down the couch? How far will the couch go before it slips its strings and flies stone-like to the road? And who shall lie beneath the couch? And who shall sue us for this couch? This is where the doorman arrives. He's watched us find and guard the couch. He's watched us find a car to carry the couch. He sees us as we try to lift the couch. This is where the doorman arrives. Like a wood chopper breaks down the door and saves a red-hooded child. Like the wand, the cartoon witch's hand that changes time, space, luck. This is the man who has the rope. This is the man who brings his muscles. And the couch is lifted to the roof of the tiny Chevy. And his rope becomes a tight fist of knots. And he tells us the story of how the couch landed on the curb just before I walked by. And how this happens all the time in the ex-East Bloc country he comes from. Oh, this moving, he says. Ah, he says. This is living. This is life.
Night has fallen on the couch. The voice of Cornelius Eady. This is the poet and the poem. The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Host production by Mike Turp and MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinibet Fund. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin. Waiting on the sun to shine.